Jessica Burtis flying the flag for North Carolina across the solar system.
Did you know that in 1991, a bill was passed by the North Carolina Senate changing the official proportions of the state flag from a length one-third more than its width to a length one-half more than its width?
Wow, there must not be a lot going on in the North Carolina Senate for them to have that kind of time on their hands.
Hi, this is Phil Lairness, sitting alongside my wife, Lily Lairness. As we travel through the third decade of the 21st century, it's good to know that the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions continue to produce a minimum of 4 hours of weekly audio goodness on Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. Why do you have that glazed expression on your face, Lil?
Too many numbers in that announcement.
Never waste an opportunity to actually engage in a midweek drive soiree, as we like to say. And we have two wonderful soireettes, if that's a word, in the Zoom room to date. Jonathan Lindsay, of course. Jonathan, we go back to the early days of the midweek drive, as we said before, when it used to be a broom cupboard somewhere in Dulwich in South London. Although, obviously, it should
that's
be
right.
South London, if we're being authentic.
South London, yeah, the Dulwich Hospital.
Yeah, there we are.
Yes.
And look where we've gone now, you know, all over the world, basically, in all sorts of magical
regions. That's true.
Who'd have thought it? The same agency that represented Vladek Shebal and a number of other fine folks who said, would you like to feature Jonathan Lindsay on the show? I said, of course we'd like to. And there we are. It just goes to show how the Amanda Pays agency could actually work through that. Was it Amanda Pays? I don't know.
Amanda Pays was my agent. It was Howard Pays who was the founder of the organisation.
The father of Amanda.
Yes. No, yes. And they were called CCA.
Exactly. Yes. Not to be confused with CCS or indeed CSI. Easily sort of confused because
none
totally
of those
different
things.
Totally different in so many ways. We also welcome from Birmingham, of course, the piano playing extraordinaire person that is Katie Grimerson. How are you, Katie?
Yeah, I'm really good.
Excellent.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, always a delight. And from San Diego, it is indeed Annette Andre. Welcome, Annette. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Alex?
All very good. In fact, you'll just see that how impressed I was with respect to your latest text. And I keep being impressed by, of course, your autobiography, that I've even actually sort of loaded it in the background. So I feel as though you're watching me in a sort of overview in any way, shape, or form. I can move to one side and we can actually see that. Move to that side as well. You see, just goes to show. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
We take our support for you very seriously over in Britain and out. So that's the important thing. We go for that. Critical stuff. I think Jonathan, you've met before, of course, as we said, Jonathan had watched Annette in many a sort of wonderful thing back in the day. Any initial questions for Annette before we launch into her audio missive for this month?
Hello, Annette. Nice to see you again.
Hello, Jonathan.
Oh, I've got to ask a question. Is that what you're asking me to ask?
You can do that.
can I? Okay, well, that's very kind of you. Annette, you have done so much television and so many different television programs. Was there a favourite program that you ever did back in the day when you were regularly on British television?
Yes, it was. I did an episode of. I did a lot of episodes of ones, and one that comes to mind. I don't know why, but it was called Mickey Dunn.
All right.
It was BBC, and it had Dinsdale Lansdown playing Mickey Dunn.
Yeah.
And we had a lovely episode together, and it was well written, and it was a very good role. And there were a couple of scenes where we were, it really was quite emotional, the two scenes, and we could never get through them in the rehearsals. We would just break off somehow, or we'd end up peeling with laughter. And it wasn't laughable. It was a kind of nerve thing or a kind of holding back, which I rarely do, but holding back because we wanted to give it all in the thing. And I enjoyed that.
Yes.
And we actually got an applause from the crew at the end of the scene when we did it finally.
Right.
You know, when, yeah. And but the director got very angry with us a lot of times. Would you mind not laughing at
Annette, you can't hurry genius. As the birds who are tweeting in the background of your San Diego yard actually are saying there, they're saying, but it's time that Annette actually delivered her audio missive. Now that Rebecca Bond and Jessica Burtis have drawn the side, that the whole audience are ready and waiting for you, Annette. So what would you like to speak to us about this month?
Curtain up, huh? It's to have and have not. A while back, a journalist friend paid me the now long out of fashion newsroom compliment of saying that I had string. By that, he meant that I had the peculiar but apparently enviable ability to find connections between seemingly diverse things and repackage them with new insights. And so it must have been string that had me attaching the title of Ernest Hemingway's novel to Have and Have Not while watching a documentary on his life, with a recent announcement that Kim Kardashian has joined the Billionaires Club alongside Amazon's Jeff Bezos and Microsoft's Bill Gates, with a man who never forgot the pain the young boy growing up in poverty suffered one Christmas Eve when his wishes didn't come true. A stark comparison of one who has and one who had not. The boy was Moss Hart, a name most won't recognize these days, but from the 1930s, he wrote or directed some of Broadway's legends, not the least of which included My Fair Lady. The pairing of the lighter-than-air Kardashian with Moss Hart was the result of my rereading his autobiography, Act One, and once again, tearing up at his description of the walk he and his father took on the night before Christmas when he was 10 years old. It had been a devastating time for him, forced to leave grade school to help support his parents' meager income. He'd given up hope that Christmas would bring him some relief from a grim existence. Here is how Moss Hart remembered that night. My father was very silent during the evening meal. Then he surprised and startled me by saying, "Let's take a walk." He never suggested such a thing before. Moreover, it was a very cold winter's night. I was even more surprised when he said, "Let's go down to 149th Street and Westchester Avenue." My heart leapt within me. That was the section of the Bronx where all the big stores were, where at Christmas, open pushcarts full of toys stood packed end to end for blocks at a stretch. I joyously concluded that this walk could mean only one thing. He was going to buy me a Christmas present. I was beside myself with delight and inner relief. It had been a very bad year for me. Not the least was the humiliation I felt at having to leave school. I wanted a present terribly. A symbol, a token of some sort that would be a sign that my father and mother knew what I was going through. We hurried on, our heads bent against the wind as we started down the line of pushcarts. There were all kinds of things that I wanted, but since nothing had been said by my father about buying a present, I would merely pause before a pushcart and say, "Oh, look at that chemistry set," or "There's a stamp album," or "There's a printing press." Each time, my father would hesitantly ask the pushcart man the price. Then, without a word, we'd move on to the next pushcart. Once or twice, he would pick up a toy, look at it, and then me, as if to suggest this might be something I would like. But I was 10 years old and had my heart set on a chemistry set or a printing press. They were on every pushcart we looked at, but the prices were always the same. Soon, I looked up and saw only two or three pushcarts remained. My father saw that too and jingled some coins in his pocket. In a flash, I knew it all. There was nothing to be had for the small amount he'd managed to put together. As I looked at him, I saw a look of despair in his eyes that brought me closer to him than I had ever been. I wanted to throw my arms around him and say, it doesn't matter, I understand. This is better than a chemistry set or a printing press. I love you. But instead, we stood shivering beside each other for a moment, then turned away from the last pushcart and started silently back home. I don't know why the words remained choked up within me. I didn't even take his hand on the way home, nor did he take mine. We were not on that basis. Nor did I tell him how close I felt to him that night, that for a little while, the concrete wall between father and son had crumbled away, and I knew that we were two lonely people struggling to reach each other. I came close to telling him many years later, but again the moment passed. It was Christmas again, and my wife and I were visiting him in his Florida living room. He was 91 and in blooming health as I sat on a sofa with him, showing him pictures of his two grandchildren. Suddenly, I felt his hand slip into mine. It was the first time in all our lives that either of us had touched the other. No words were spoken, and I went on turning the pages of the photo album. But my hand remained in his, nor did I tell him what I was thinking and feeling. The moment was enough. It had taken 40 years for the gulf that separated us to close.
Well, I have to say, Annette, I mean, I can almost feel Jessica and Rebecca and Katie and Jonathan and myself in tears on that sort of emotional routine and that sort of stuff. I mean, yeah, I know. Rebecca, I overwhelmed.
I had to read it several times before so I could get used to it, because I inevitably cry at that bit. And I could feel it coming up then, but I had to stop. Can you hear me?
We can indeed. And the birdies.
Right in the middle of the speech, I nearly fell off the chair. Our upstairs neighbor has their air conditioner fan out here, and it suddenly switched on, and it is so loud.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yes.
I thought somebody had fired a sort of comedy arrow at you from a cartoon. You know, when that twang sound. It was interesting. An air conditioning unit switching on.
It took me into so many sort of strange and bizarre ways that I literally went all over the place, literally upside down with respect to happiness and wonderment, and then sort of saying, I'll just leave it now. And just in case Jonathan was thinking, look, we started these programs off so many times before, I have got a sort of special treat for your good self coming up in a matter of seconds, Jonathan, which I'm sure you appreciate. In fact, it might actually sort of be coming up quite literally now in terms of the way forward. So I think you can see that. We've obviously, I just moved to one side. Jonathan Lindsay.
Oh,
there
we are. Gosh, that's me.
Show me that.
In character, Jonathan, as of course Ogilvy, I believe.
That's right, yes. The human version, having returned from being a monster. We were half men, half fish for most of the movie. Mm. And then we turned back into those creatures at the end. So, yeah, we had to grow beards. Which was quite a revelation, because I hadn't grown a beard for a very long time, and it grew in grey, and I was really surprised by that. I expected it to be black, but there you go.
So you see, Annette, that you know, whenever sort of things are sort of, you need to just put things in perspective, at least you've never had to play half human, half fish, I believe. But let's open it up to the discussions, etc. Jessica Burtis, welcome aboard. How were the exams, by the way? Did they all go well that you've been having earlier today?
Yeah, it's over, thankfully. I submitted my exam with a minute left. So I am tired, but glad it's over. So,
well, you see, your reward, Jessica, is you get a chance to actually connect once again with Jonathan Lindsley and Annette Andre. So what questions would you like to put to the team?
I'm very curious. Do you guys have any plans for the upcoming month? What are your expectations for May? Do you guys have any projects you want to work on?
Who?
Well, sorry.
Both of you. I guess Annette, I can ask you first. What are your plans for May?
Are you talking to me? I'm sorry, I've got this thing in the background.
Sorry.
My plans for May. Oh, I am going, we, Arthur and I, in 2 weeks' time, are going out to have lunch at a restaurant.
Wow.
It will be the first time in 15 months that we've been out, you know, like that, or to sit and have coffee or do something, because we're now fully vaccinated and we've got 2 weeks. Arthur had his yesterday, I had mine the other day. And we've got 2 weeks now for it all to take over, and then off we go. That's my plan. It's a big celebration.
Congratulations. That's exciting. It is. Thanks, exciting.
You have no idea how exciting it is. Yes. I've spoken to a couple of my friends, women friends, on the phone, and I've said, guess what? We can go and have coffee soon. We can sit out and have coffee. Oh, lunch.
It makes me feel so special. It's something that I feel like, you know, looking back, I'm like, I just took eating out at restaurants for granted. And now it feels like a very big celebratory occasion when you actually get to go and experience that again.
Absolutely. I never thought I'd ever in my life be saying something like that.
And Jonathan, are you going to be equally as adventurous? You've also had your second vaccination, I believe. So you're pretty much waiting for a similar thing.
Well, yes, I think we unlock, as it were, on the 17th of May, is it? I think we're allowed to go and see each other in houses again, and we're allowed to visit restaurants and go indoors in pubs instead of sitting outside in the freezing cold, because we've had the coldest April known to man here in the UK for the last 4 weeks. It's been really, really chilly. But some brave souls have been sitting outside the seafront pubs here where I live in Bexhill-on-Sea in East Sussex. And they've been very good, actually. They've provided people with rugs and all sorts of stuff to keep them warm while they obviously needed to drink a glass of wine in the evening. But so my plan for May will be to experience the chance of going to other people's homes, perhaps having dinner and enjoying that. And of course, what I will also be able to do is meet some of the people that I've only met online so far. So that would be rather special.
Steady on, Jonathan. You don't want to start going crazy IRL in real life. Don't know where we could be going on that basis. You know, it's all a question of, are we real? Are we not real? I mean, I still don't believe Birmingham exists, but maybe Katie will be able to convince us otherwise. Katie, have you got any questions you'd like to put to either Annette or Jonathan, or indeed Rebecca or Jessica?
To Jonathan, do you go to the New Forest much?
I don't often go to the New Forest. I have been to the New Forest. I once stayed in a rather lovely hotel in the New Forest, which was somewhere, I can't actually remember the place it was. It was in a tiny little village, and it was really quiet during the week because people were, it was a weekend place really. So we had this hotel to ourselves, and one night the actual owners of the hotel gave us the keys and said, could you lock up for us because we're going into Bournemouth. And we had this country house hotel with 36 rooms and a swimming pool to ourselves for an evening. And that was rather exciting. Yeah. But of course, once you get used to that, sitting by an open fire in the New Forest and thinking you own a 36 room mansion, it's quite depressing on a Friday evening when about 37 or 38 other couples arrive for the weekend and they sort of take over your home that you've got used to for a week. So, but I do love the New Forest. It's fantastic. And I love the ponies. I love the whole feeling of it. We visited the place where William the Conqueror's son was shot. When I think he was shot, they said accidentally by a hunter, but in fact he was murdered. So that would be William Rufus, who was murdered in the New Forest by a great rock. And that was fascinating. So yes, I like the New Forest. Why do you ask anyway, Katie?
We've been to the New Forest a few times. My sister lives in Portsmouth.
All right.
She's quite outdoorsy, and the New Forest is one of the places where we always go. So when we can start visiting people again, I can't wait to go to Portsmouth and venture out to the New Forest and see all the ponies. I like Arundel as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, that area is really lovely and very historic, which is smashing. So,
yeah. Jonathan, yeah. Don't talk about history. We've got two Americans actually online at present. We don't want to sort of offend them in terms of history. It's very, by the way, Jessica, New Forest suggests there's an Old Forest somewhere. I don't know where the Old Forest actually happens to be. I've never managed to actually identify that at all. Maybe Rebecca can actually help us. Rebecca, over to yourself. Any other thoughts or questions for yourself after basically three Zoomers in a row?
I mean, I'm glad we just had a bit of a conversation because, Annette, when you read the extract, which was beautiful, by the way, I had to choke back tears. That was very emotional. I mean, for me, family is like one of the biggest things. I love my family. We're really close and we tell each other we love each other all the time. So I was wondering why you picked that extract, because I do think it talks about a very human aspect and I really enjoyed it. And I think that was really beautiful. And what was it that stood out to you that made you want to read it today?
The haves and the have-nots. I titled thing "To Have and Have Not," based on the book that was written by Hemingway. That's it. It's one of those moments. yes, and it just seemed, you know, there she is, who has done nothing, standing up being a billionaire. And here is somebody who was so talented and had to go through having to leave school in those days that just so many people were out of work and jobs. I mean, this, we're talking about the 19-teens, you know, the 1910 onwards. And it was a very, they had no money, the family, they just had no money. And he grew
and they
up.
Had the Spanish flu as well. I mean, it was like a lose-lose situation. No money and the Spanish flu. It's unbelievable.
That's right. It was. It was. It was dreadful. So I just, it just seemed such a, I loved this autobiography of Moss Hart. I mean, I just think it's the most wonderful book. It's called Act One. So if anyone gets your hands on it, you should read it. It's really wonderful. It's very, quite funny in parts. Because he's brilliant. I mean, he's such a comedian. He's had a wonderful sense of humor. So that's my reply.
No, I loved it. I think it was beautiful. I think it was beautifully written and very, as I said, human too. So
the book. Try and get it. It's called Act.
I will. I will. It sounds amazing.
Moss Hart, H-A-R. Okay.
So I'm still not quite a patch on where I've been all my life by Annette André, but that's by the by in terms of biographies. I mean,
you know,
it's the, you know, subliminally putting the thing up there, even though it is radio. I don't care. Jonathan, have you
also beautifully written. I'm sorry, go on.
Any other questions, Jonathan, you'd like to put to the team?
Oh, well, yeah, I'd just like to say hello to Rebecca, because I don't think we've met before, have we?
No, we haven't. It's nice to meet you, Jonathan.
Pleased to meet you, Rebecca. And also, hi, Jess. I didn't really say that when you asked me a question earlier. I just kind of ranted on about what I was doing.
No worries.
So, hello, Jessica. Hello. And have I got a question that I... Well, yes, I want to know, because we've got several members of the younger generation here, and Annette and I are people who've seen quite a lot of time pass.
Jonathan, let's just use the term, we are experientially enhanced.
We're experienced people. And I wondered if it struck a chord with anybody else about the fact of parents not showing enough affection to their children. Because I was saying only the other day, actually, that I don't remember my father ever kissing me or hugging me in my life. I have no memory. I mean, he may have done before I was old enough to know it. But as a child who was aware, he was it just wasn't done that a father would hug his son or kiss his son.
Not and I
just
in North, if, Jonathan. I mean, obviously,
well, certainly
in Yorkshire.
Not in Yorkshire, but my dad was from the southeast. But it was the same thing. It was a generational thing, I think. And I just wondered if younger people had any experience of that with brothers or fathers or whatever. Is that common, or to me it seemed perfectly normal when I was a child, but now I hear other people talk about it and they say, oh yeah, I was very close to my father. And the hand holding moment was a big thing for me when you read that extract, because I think my dad did hold my hand at times when I was a small boy, but I don't remember him ever kissing me or hugging me ever. And that's a big regret, I think, in life. And I think it's a good thing, perhaps, that life has changed.
I mean, if I may, I'd like to go first.
Yes.
Because as I said, I mean, we're really close to the family, and that applies to extended family too. It's not just my mum, my dad and my sister. We're really close, but it extends to, you know, aunties, uncles, cousins, grandparents. It does expand. So for us, we're a very close family, and we always have had that very physical affection in our family. So for us, it's very normal. And I think that is our love language, but I don't think that's necessarily applicable to every family. I think some people are different, but from my perspective, we definitely do show it in a physical way. You know, there is lots of love. We're always telling each other. It's not unusual. And I think it's probably unusual if we go a day without telling each other, but that's just us. And I think sometimes, I don't know if this applies to everyone, but I find that sometimes, do you think it could be could it be gender related? Because I find that a lot of the boys that I know don't have affectionate families or necessarily physical affectionate relationships with their parents, but girls tend to more. Do you think that could be a pattern as well?
Oh, I think it's certainly gender related. But I found it, it's very interesting because, I mean, boys didn't cry.
Yes.
We didn't show emotion.
Yeah.
We weren't allowed to touch one another.
We don't cry, Jonathan.
You can hug your mum.
As Robert Smith said in The Cure, boys don't cry. It's the title of the song.
Yes, absolutely. Well, how do you feel, Alexis? Alex, you're an experienced gentleman. Did you have a good relationship with your dad?
I had a good relationship. It wasn't a particularly tactile relationship. I mean, I think it's a case of, on that basis. I mean, clearly, only got a few more months before basically I reached the time he was when he popped his clogs. So who knows what could happen. But anyway, it goes. Transcendence, that's the important thing. I'll keep on going. we'll zoom from heaven. But as I say, bottom line, Rebecca, treat every day as though it could be your last, because one day it will be. Jessica.
Oh, don't.
It's just a basic fact of life. Jessica, what about yourself in North Carolina?
I feel like here people are very affectionate. It's like everyone hugs.
It's the sweet tea, Jessica. It's the sweet tea.
It is. It's just, I feel like, I don't know. There is a lot of affection here. And in my family as well, I don't think it's really a gendered thing because we've all shown each other affection before. It's not really like a boy-girl thing. Although I do think that gender definitely has affected that in the past. I don't know how much it still does, but I think in my family, everyone was kind of honest about that and about their emotions as well. I feel like more so rather than showing affection, it was like emotions in my family. I never have seen my dad cry. Ever. But I remember the first time I ever saw my mom cry was when we watched Bridge to Terabithia, which is such an emotional movie. And I can remember I was so little, and I remember thinking that like adults didn't cry. I thought that like parents were incapable of crying because I thought that they couldn't experience like that kind of like very vulnerable moment. And
parents are very difficult to bring into the world, Jessica.
They are. You got to raise them right. And I was just so disturbed. I remember I just started crying when I saw my mom upset because that was just like such a shift in my worldview. But yeah, as far as affection goes, we've always shown affection. I was a very like clingy baby. I needed to be held all the time, just all the time. So I feel like maybe I'm just very affectionate.
You, in many ways, you're the female equivalent, Jessica, of the cats in Shrek, really. You know, that sort of, oh, please, you know, just please. You know, it's amazing. Still, perhaps not. Katie, what about yourself?
So for me, I'm very close to my mum, and there is both an emotional and physical, love between us. But with my dad, it's a bit different. Like, it's more emotional, and he does give me some tough love because I need tough love, but he doesn't really hug me or anything, but I know that he does love me, if that makes sense, because he helps me out because I've just bought a new keyboard which was quite expensive, and he said I'll help Katie out, I'll pay half of it, which I thought was really nice. So I guess that's a way of him showing his affection to me.
And you're quite close to your grandfather as well, Katie, I think, as far as I know.
Yes, I am. Close to my granddad and my nan as well, yeah. And my sister, even though she lives in Portsmouth.
and goes into the New Forest for what we don't know, but still, never mind. Was that what you were expecting, Jonathan? Was it kind of, yes. Snapshot?
I also wanted to go right back to the beginning of what Annette said about her favourite show that she was involved with Dinsdale Landon. I think you said Dinsdale Landon, and you said about playing emotion, an emotional scene.
Yes.
And it meant that you started laughing. Was that out of embarrassment at the emotion, or was it about public shows of emotion?
No, it was nothing to do with that. It was the fact that we knew that it could reach a peak in within the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow or other, we stopped at reaching that point in a rehearsal.
Right.
And I don't usually do that. I believe you rehearse and you do it as a performance as you go on.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, for both of us, it stopped. And the emotional thing was we would laugh, which was like a knee-jerk thing, you know.
Yes.
And when we actually did do it, it just went beautifully.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it did that whole thing. I mean, it wasn't over the top and it wasn't under, but it was, I haven't really ever experienced anything like that before. And I've played a lot of emotional things, you know, but that was one. And another one, actually, I'm thinking about was my episode I did in May Gray.
All right, yes.
Worked with Richard Harris. It was the talk about senior moments. It was the pilot for the actual series. And I had a scene with Richard, and I'm supposed to be talking about my husband who's just been killed and things. And we only had a couple of rehearsals for lines and things. But when we did it, I actually did start to cry. Very, you know, I mean, it was good because I could control it and the thing. And it worked really well. And Richard was very helpful and played with it. You know, it was so I'm an emotional person anyway. I'm half Italian. So, and going back to parents, my parents were a loving family. And my father had no trouble giving me a hug or a kiss or whatever. He was half Italian. So, you know, that all came out. He was Italian. And my mother was just a lovely, warm, giving mother. So I was very lucky, but I've had many friendships where several girlfriends and a couple of men I've known, yes, definitely a couple of men I've known very much, who had such cold relationships with their parents. You know, one that I'm thinking about was, they're very wealthy people, and he was put into a boarding school at the age of 7. And
as late as that, Annette?
As late as that, exactly. Then he went to Stowe, I think it was Stowe, yes, for his, when he got into high school. And he was there as boarding for 6 years, and never once did his parents ever visit him in the school. They'd have him delivered to them wherever they happened to be on holiday or something to join them. And that was it. I can never understand that. I really can't.
Yeah. Unnecessary chore. What the hey? Outrageous. I mean, we've covered family in all sorts of aspects, which has been quite amazing. A little tease ahead, of course, to another program, which of course features the wonderful Arthur Weingarten. A little clue in terms of that, because we've just actually had confirmed that together with Jonathan Lindsley and indeed the wonders of Jessica and Rebecca, who'll be joining us for Resonance Rewind. That's the programme that we're going to be considering on Resonance Rewind. For the benefit of the listener, of course, it is Jonathan. What programme in particular?
It's The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Exactly. And we'll be finding out how Jonathan had to have that ultimate task of deciding, did he actually go to the Cubs or did he watch The Man from U.N.C.L.E.? Probably the episode Arthur Weingarten wrote, actually, which we're going to be looking at, which, of course, is the season four episode, The Thrush Roulette Affair. Let's just test this with our two other junior Residence Rewinders. Rebecca, have you ever encountered any episodes of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. before?
I have not, and can I be honest, I've never heard of it. So I'm being very well educated on this programme.
This is good. This is what it's all about. And Jessica Burtis, what about yourself and The Adventures of Napoleon Solo, Ilya Kuryakin, and of course the man from the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement?
Is it related to the movie? Or is the show like about different characters?
No, actually the movie in many ways is a prequel. Some might say it's a completely separate sort of universe, but you're absolutely right. Guy Ritchie did indeed do a movie based on this with Henry Cavill and indeed Armie Hammer as the eponymous Solo and Kuryakin. And I believe that Jonathan Lindsay lookalike Hugh Grant actually took on board the line of Alexander Waverley. But that's just by the by, really. It's probably because Jonathan was in the New Forest. That's the only reason. Or actually half man, half fish. We don't know. Katie, would you like to put the last two questions to the team, please?
Yes. Have you all had an interesting telephonic, well, no Zoom app with us today? I'm used to saying telephonic.
I know. So locked into telephonic links. So last decade, Katie, we've moved on. Annette, has it been good for you?
Oh, yes. Very. It's great. Very interesting. I like all the give and take and chat and things. Yes.
Virtual hugs, and let's hopefully that Rebecca will hold back the emotions, because it's emotionally overwhelming, really. Rebecca, okay for yourself?
It's been amazing, yeah, and I like the emotional side of it. I mean, like I said, I'm quite an affectionate and emotional person. I think it's good to talk about these things, so yeah, it's been really good.
Yeah, I like to feel that these shows have kind of developed Jonathan as kind of therapy, really. I mean, they've always had that sort of aspect on them, but you know, we've rolled them out. How about yourself, Jonathan? Have you enjoyed the Zoom?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yes, I always do. And it's been fascinating to meet everyone again and to meet new people as well, which is great. And yes, though, thank you very much for sharing your emotional journeys with me. And I look forward to meeting you all again. Thank you very much.
There you are. And Jessica, on a day which has had your exam, plus all sorts of other aspects, etc. Is that the final exam now? Or are there any more tests you need to go through?
There are more. I have two more papers, a few more assignments, another exam. So we have I miss the exam schedule in the UK because we have a finals week here. So like your finals are like, you can have up to three in one day. That's like the rule. You can't have any more than three exams in one day, but it's just, it's a lot during COVID. So.
Well, the bottom line, Jessica, you've got the Midweek Drive team on your side, yes. So all will be well. That's the important thing, and you doubtless will return. So, Annette, back again in May after the joyous, exciting time of going out to eat in a restaurant.
Absolutely, yes, and hopefully I will have been to the hairdresser for the first time in 15 months. So
you couldn't look any more glamorous, honestly. You know, it's just.
Oh yes. It's not enough being older that you actually have to go with your hair. I won't tell you what I've done with it today to make it.
it's a whole new world. Katie, will you be returning?
Yes, if you have me, Alec.
Good. Well, keep playing the piano. We'll work our way through that, no doubt. Rebecca, we'll see you again very soon. In fact, you're back with the film review tomorrow, I believe.
I'll see you tomorrow.
Jessica, keep on giving, catch up with you next week. And Jonathan, likewise, happy trails, be well, and remember, show some affection.
Exactly.
Well, the old song by Sister Sledge went, "We Are Family," and latest figures show that there are currently over 2,000 children waiting to be adopted in England, and of those, 44% are in family groups of two or more. So what if you are actually considering the notion of adopting both brothers and sisters, or indeed siblings in all sorts of ways? Well, this actually ties in with the national hashtag You Can Adopt campaign. And to talk us through some of the aspects relating to this, we're delighted to welcome child psychologist extraordinaire, Dr. Elizabeth Kilby. How are you, Elizabeth?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. So, I mean, I'm speaking as an only child, so I have no relationship with siblings whatsoever from that point of view. So I'm probably least experienced in terms of this. But it does seem to be a case of actually, in terms of family groups and adopting family groups, there's a psychological well-being to be said for them.
Absolutely right. So what we know is that children get a huge amount of emotional and social support. It's a real buffering having your brothers and sisters with you, your blood relatives, the people that tie you back to your heritage. To have those with you, to have those shared memories and those life stories to support you is such a strong foundation for children in order to be able to then build on, to build relationships in their new adoptive families.
I suspect that people might have concerns about adopting brothers and sisters just from the point of view of the financial packages and possibly other side aspects that come through them. But are they offset by the benefits that ensue as a result of a family group?
I can really understand. I mean, it does feel really daunting. And if you think about in sort of birth families, we don't normally have multiple children. It's one at a time. People get a chance to adjust. It's a sort of slower process. And adopting a brother and sister group can feel really daunting. And we know that adopters talk to us about some of the practical and the logistical concerns, but also the financial worries. What is available now is a huge amount of information and support to adopters, particularly adopters who are going to be having brothers and sisters and family groups with them. And that's some of the information that we've got available on the website. And I really want to encourage people to go and have a look at the youcanadopt.com/brothers and sisters website, because there's an absolute wealth of information. And what's so powerful is the videos and the information from adopters who have taken or have introduced brothers and sisters into their families and just what that experience has been like for them.
Mm. And it's interesting, even Sunita, who obviously much beloved 20th century performer, etc., adopted a brother and sister in 2007. Her experience, I think, is also well worth noting, because it does show that, you know, again, there's the human family, but also those familiar bonds can actually be really impactful as well in people's general development and well-being.
I mean, that's exactly right. We did a survey actually and asked 2,000 members of the public what their relationships with their brothers and sisters are. And 52% said that having a brother or sister have made them a better person. And 54% said that having a brother or sister has provided them with emotional support and companionship. This is such an important part of everybody's everyday lives. And the fact that we can give this to children who are moving into permanency, to adoption families, which is a stressful experience. Let's not get around that. This is a tough thing that everyone's doing. And the more support we can give to children to make this process successful, the more support that we can give to adopters, the more families we're making. And that's what I'm really passionate about.
Particularly intrigued to find that 61% of those surveyed actually suggested that adopting children with their brothers or sisters had actually been the most beneficial factor in their children's adoption journey. And again, from a psychological point of view, increasing your reassurance, companionship, comfort. I mean, we know that certain sibling relationships can be fraught, they can be tense and so on, but ultimately, presumably, again, it's a case of, in most cases, there are much more positives than negatives.
I mean, all sibling relationships, all brother and sister relationships can be challenging, whether that's in a birth family or an adoption family. That's part of the territory. But also that's really important, because our brother and sister relationships are probably the closest, most enduring, at times most honest relationships we'll have with anyone. Our brothers and sisters are the people on the planet who are most close to us genetically. They're the most similar that we're going to find. And so, you know, that's going to breed intense connections and love, but also conflict and difference. And managing those things is really important. It's part of our learning and our growing up. And for adoptive parents to be part of that journey, to foster and nurture those relationships, to build those links, is what they tell us is hugely important about the experience of adopting children sibling groups.
And presumably there's ample support structures in place for people who might sort of think, yes, we're going to adopt, we're going to go with this, etc., which is fantastic. They may well go to youcanadopt.co.uk, but clearly this is a huge life-changing decision that's being made, and in many cases probably needs some supportive structures as well in place.
I mean, there is a huge amount of support for adopters, and we know that many adopters who come forward might not have considered brother and sister groups. It's not something that people immediately think about. You know, they think about starting their adoption journey. What we really want to encourage people is to consider this as part of their experience. Actually, the adopters that we spoke to said initially that they hadn't thought about brother and sister groups, but when they met their child and they met their brothers and sisters, it seemed the most natural decision in the world. So we really want to encourage people to consider this, to put this on their radar, that this is something that they could really do. And it's no more daunting than the adoption process, even for one child.
Well, let's just share that go-to website to find out further information, further details about people who might just be considering going into an adoption route. Elizabeth, the best website is?
youcanadopt.co.uk/brothers-and-sisters.
Dr. Elizabeth Kilby, child psychologist, huge thanks indeed. Keep on keeping on. And
thank you.
I always feel saying to a psychologist, be well, is always slightly ironic, because of course you're going to be well. You've got the whole sort of psychological approach to the whole thing, but be well and be safe. Cheers there.
Thank you so much.
So the vaccine campaign is well underway, and indeed we're heading up to that whole side of things where my Edward Jenner would obviously be delighted to find that his notion of vaccination has really sort of been echoed in terms of actually hopefully beginning to address the issue of the COVID pandemic and so on, of people aged 50 and under now being urged to get their COVID-19 vaccine when their term comes in a new campaign. And to talk us through these key elements and why it is important to actually go and receive your vaccination and so on, we're delighted to welcome that awesome medic. We've said it many times before. It's Dr. Zoe Williams. How are you, Zoe?
I'm great. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back again.
Excellent. So in terms of this particular vaccine rollout, et cetera, I mean, it's a huge task that we've been going through. I mean, obviously 33.5 million people have now received a first dose of a vaccine. 12 million are actually onto their second dose already. So it's going well, but clearly it is important to ensure that you make your appointment, you get booked in and you get vaccinated, presumably.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It is going really, really well. And it's incredibly important that we keep that momentum going. And we're entering now the next phase. It's the second phase of the vaccination programme, where the main target audience for this huge ad campaign that launches today is people under the age of 50. And I think it recognises that people in the younger age groups, the motivations for getting vaccinated can be slightly different. Right at the beginning, when we started vaccinating people over the age of 70 and people who were clinically extremely vulnerable, they were highly motivated to come and get the vaccine because their lives have been heavily restricted for the past year. And I think at the moment, as we're coming out of lockdown as well, for younger people, especially people who are in their 20s and 30s, they might not feel that it's as important to get vaccinated. But of course it is. It's important that all of us come forward and have the jab when we're invited. And that's why the tagline for this campaign is every vaccination gives us hope. And it does.
Now, one of the other aspects which clearly emerges from the multi-faceted world of social media that we live in is that you need to actually differentiate between real news, like we're doing now, and indeed false news, which you tend to get lots of channels of. So it's important to actually consult trusted sources. Certainly, we know that over the last few years, there have been lots of people who have been moving for a variety of completely erroneous reasons towards anti-vaccination campaigns and so on and so forth. It's important you actually do check out the genuine information on genuine website, Zoe, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. I think the information sources where you take that information from is incredibly important. And whilst it's very small numbers actually of people who are anti-vax, there have been significant numbers of people this year who've been more hesitant. And I think it's understandable. I really sympathise with people who have hesitancy because it is a new vaccine. It has come about quickly. And therefore, understandably, people have concerns. But I feel like there's really been a shift recently, especially in those minor ethnic groups where there was more hesitancy. I think sometimes people just need to step back for a moment, and they may say, oh, it's all very well that you're presenting the data, the evidence, the research, but they just want to see with their own eyes. And we've reached a stage now in this country where, as you mentioned before, 33.5 million people have been vaccinated. We're seeing that the vaccination program is highly effective at protecting people, and it is very, very safe as well. So I think now people are witnessing that with their own eyes. They're seeing it from family and friends. They're seeing it in their communities. We are now seeing that some of those concerns about certain ethnic groups, those people are now coming forwards and taking up the vaccine, which is really good news.
We've seen this weekend, of course, sporting activities, the Carabao Cup final, which actually has been experimenting with respect to having people attending. Do you think that as more and more people get vaccinated and work through the process, we can see an increase in terms of numbers that are able to actually go in there? Or will it still be a case of, no, if you want to go in there, you still got to do your lateral flow testing, everything else still needs to be in place as well?
I mean, they're all important. They're all important measures. And I think the roadmap that the government has set out, I think I feel quite confident now about that. As long as the vaccination programme continues to be as successful, we hope that people will take up this lateral flow testing twice a week, whether you're going to events or not, because that helps us identify cases of people with COVID who are asymptomatic. And of course, continuing to follow the hands, face, space, fresh air rules, especially as we sort of start socialising and seeing people again. All three of those factors are important. And you could almost say that the more people come forward and have the vaccine, perhaps the less likely it will be, or the less likely we will need to continue for longer periods of time some of the other measures that are in place. But it does, I mean, it does feel like in this country, we really are making progress. Things are starting to slowly get back to normal. Things are moving in the right direction. Hopefully we'll be able to continue to open things up. And we can't deny that a big chunk of that success, if we compare ourselves to other European countries, for example, is down to the success of the vaccination programme. So, yeah, the key message is, you know, to people, getting life back to normal, being hopeful, every vaccination gets us one small step closer.
And we're certainly seeing in India at present, obviously, some of the tragedies that are ensuing with respect to situations where the virus is once again raging, it would seem, out of control. So, again, I think if you're looking for additional motivation, that's another side of things. I have my own second vaccination appointment booked for the end of June. But I was fascinated by, obviously, the line, "What a difference a day makes," which, of course, is the cover. It's a cover version of that that's being used for this TV advert. I mean, is that the ideal line to go for, do you think, Zoe?
Do you know what? I think it's a song of real hope, isn't it? I think when I watched that advert and that song playing, "What a Difference a Day Makes," it really, really resonated. And I think, you know, if I go back to when we were first vaccinating, you know, the first groups of people that were eligible, for them, that was so true. They get dressed up. You know, I had so many patients who were saying, "This is the first time I've come out of my house." For some of them, the first time they'd seen another person in the flesh for 10 months. So, you know, for those people, it certainly was true what a difference that day made to them. But even though people in their 20s and 30s might not feel that their life is changing so much because they're getting the vaccine on any particular day, every vaccine does make a difference. So I think, yeah, it's a really fitting song. And I think the ad campaign is really positive and optimistic and hopeful. And that's what we need. We need a little bit of that right now.
See, personally, I would have either gone for Beethoven's "Ode to Joy" or possibly Boney M and "Hooray, Hooray, It's a Holiday." Either of those two, really. But maybe that's just a personal thing. Whatever. Where can people go to find out further details, Zoe, about the campaign, see the ad, and indeed the NHS in general?
So I think you'll see the ad. It'd be difficult to avoid it. It's going to be everywhere. If people want more information about the vaccination programme, I always direct people to the NHS website. So just nhs.uk/ COVID vaccination. And, you know, as you mentioned before, anyone who is 44 and above can now go on that site and book in. And everybody else, wait until you're asked to come forwards. But if you are asked, you know, even if people in their 30s are asked to come forwards this week, you're not jumping the queue. It is your turn in your area. So go for it.
Zoe, as ever, an absolute delight. Keep on keeping on. Be well, be safe, and be happy. Cheers now.
Thank you so much.